Now is the time we're going to have some announcements. Do a little business after lunch each time we get together. Does anybody have an announcement they'd like to bring into the circle? Sure. Only because this can be recorded, and if somebody's listening later, they'll get this information as well.
I'm planning on going a field trip to a Bayagiri monastery for the Half Moon Puja. Yeah, so I haven't yet, so I'm super pumped next Friday for the Half Moon. If anyone else wants to go, we can carpool because it's 3 hours up to Redwood, but I just want to make that announcement.
Great, thank you.
Just making the announcement because Sage is not here, so he might benefit. This is after striking out at Stanford Hospital with the volunteer positions there and not getting too much response from El Camino Hospital. The Santa Clara Valley Medical Center, we have this Reverend Max who graduated from here in the chaplaincy program. He's interested in accepting volunteers, so that might be something anybody's interested in. The South Bay. So,
thank you.
I have a question. This is just a question for everybody. I'm thinking about doing the Stephen Levine program that I've now lost the title of, A Year to Live. So if anyone else has done that, I'd like to talk with you separately sometime and hear more about it. No, it would be taught through my local Sangha in Santa Cruz. Thanks.
No.
Oh, you bet.
I have a question around expectation for getting feedback on our writing assignments. I don't know if it's different for each of the different people, but I have yet to get feedback on any of my writing assignments, and I'm just curious the timeline.
We're each racking our brains about who's supposed to read your papers. It's not you?
No.
Who is it?
It's also you. when we might hear back feedback about our writing assignments.
Ideally, it would be before the next class. You submit it, but I'm way behind. So I'm going to try to catch up over the holidays. Sorry about that. Life has been very full.
I don't think your mic's on.
I don't have anything on.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I was trying to speak up.
Oh, okay.
Should I repeat that? You heard me, I guess.
Other announcements or inquiries?
I have the opposite question. So I've kindly received feedback already from Paul, and I was wondering, do I add more to the paper? Do I share my reflection upon your reflection? Like, was there a thing? I just want to make sure I'm not missing any assignments. Exactly, a conversation.
I mean, the short answer is you don't need to. But if there's if there's something about it that feels unfinished that you really feel you would benefit from exploring, you could either contact me Or the next time you have an interview with one of us, that might be a good thing to bring up there.
But there are no rewrites. You know, you won't get feedback like, rewrite it. No, we just forward momentum. Yeah.
And I do have a style of, but part of my comment, it might be a question, but it's not like, oh, well, you're supposed to answer that. No, that's just like a reflection you could do. Like, oh, what would I say in that case?
Other pieces to put into the community circle? I have one piece, but I'm waiting to see if there's anything else. No?
I have one piece too.
Great.
Which is like the interviews, I would really encourage you to sign up for them. That you could find, especially now as you're settling in. You know, I know at the start, you feel like, well, we've barely started, and I haven't even read that book yet, and I don't have an internship. What would I say? You know, maybe that's what I would say, and that would be a very short conversation. But you can even just reflect on your responses to what happens in class and see what that opens up for you in terms of practice.
I want to confirm that the faculty meetings, there are some months we skip. You have one-on-one meeting with the faculty right once a month.
And then you rotate through us as well.
Yeah.
So like if you, okay. So month one would be me, but and then you would skip two, and then month three you'll be with Paul. Skip four, the next one's with Gil, and then it circles back. Yeah. I'm sorry, go ahead. But I want to finish on the mentor interviews. It's also a service to us for you to come to the mentor interviews because we design some of our time together based on what's happening for you. And we talk to you during lunch and we hear from you in class. But, you know, sometimes when we're doing some planning, something may be arising in a couple different places and then we know. So it's also a way to keep a circle going, if you will. Yeah, I think it's useful that way. Please.
I was curious if we could do a name and pronoun go around before we end this part. It would be supportive to me. And I think we didn't do it this morning.
Have we done it every morning?
Actually, no, we just did it last time and the first time.
Great. You want to get us started? Teach
sure.
us how to do it?
Sure. I'm Elisa, and I use they, them pronouns. Thanks.
Sharon, she, her. Casey, she, her.
Sri, he, his.
Alan, he, his.
Clarence, he, him.
AJ, she, her.
Alan, he, his.
Jennifer, she, hers.
Paul, he, him.
Gil, he, him.
Kay, she, her. I feel like I should say Sage. She, her.
Thank you.
Barbara, she, her.
Conrad, and I'm just going to voice this, that this is something I'm contemplating right now, the pronoun ritual and working on it myself in solidarity with the group, he, his, but it's just something I'm exploring and learning about the few months. So,
Kristen, she, her.
Letisa, she, her.
So then the question arises for me, is there an expectation or a wish to do this on a regular basis?
My thought is that if people are noticing that they're being misgendered with pronouns and or their names are being mispronounced, that, you know, they could request that we go around again and remind all of us, or remind each other.
So that would be more occasionally as something arises, as compared to building it in that, for example, we could say every time that we meet in person, we do it. And we don't have to decide this right now, but it's kind of a question that came to me in thinking about the group as a whole. Okay, well, how about this? You may not want to bring it up or think about it out loud because you need to think about it more, or maybe you might want to talk to one of us and not kind of put in a request at the kind of most public level. But the invitation stands. Okay? Is that fair enough? Okay, great. My announcement is just, I know we're all kind of focused on getting to the end of the year. We'll meet in January, and before you know it, we're going to be going on retreat in February, which is a 2-day overnight at the Insight Meditation Retreat Center in the Santa Cruz Mountains. So you have the date, it's on your calendar, but I'm just weaving in front of you right now to say next month we'll really be gearing up to go. There'll be communications coming from IRC and Gil about what's entailed. I don't know if there's anything you want to let people know now, Gil, as compared to in January.
Two things. One is you'll get an email with a request to register. It's all run by volunteers down there, and so having everyone plugged into the system, participating in it, makes it all easier. So part of the system is to register. It's very simple registration, but if you can do that promptly when you get the email request. And then I think it's, I have to double check, but I'm pretty sure that if you want to come early, the day before, like it starts Friday, Saturday, but if you want to come on Thursday, so you're there Thursday and ready to go Friday morning rather than driving someplace from far, far away, that can be arranged. And if it helps for you to stay Saturday night, that's also an option for the people who live far away. So there'll be more information about this, but just letting you know for now.
Okay, great. That's the end of our announcement session. Cool. Great. So moving on. Does anybody by any chance remember Barbara Walters?
Of course.
You do. What do you remember? Just shout out loud, I'll repeat it. What do you remember about Barbara Walters?
She asked a lot of questions.
She asked a lot of questions. What else? Very personable. Mm-hmm. She's one of the first female television journalists. It was all men in Barbara Walters once upon a time. Okay. So we're going to have a Barbara Walters style interview right now.
I thought this was going to be the last section.
It is?
You have your thing first. You can change them around if you want.
You know what? I would like to change them around because I think it's going to be lively and help with the after lunch stupor phenomena. Would that be okay?
Yes, sure.
Okay.
Well, the stakes are high now.
That's right. You got to keep everybody awake.
Can we stop?
So I'm going to interview Gil and Paul. I'm going to be Barbara Walters. And they're going to... But let me say a few things about that. These guys weren't so sure who Barbara Walters is, so I just thought I'd make sure somebody else did. But we wanted to talk with you a little bit about and help you think about, learn about the realm of archetypes and the role of the chaplain. So, for example, the two people on the video that you watched, I thought articulated in some ways their own practice and which pieces of the Dharma they operationalized to do the work that they do. They both also had what I would call a great deal of integration, that their personhood and their call to service and their spiritual practice and their clarity and focus was pretty strong, you know. So in religious training, there's a learning journey that's called spiritual formation. So I want to introduce you to this, if you haven't heard this term before. And when I think about this training in the context of religious training, other people where people learn to be spiritual leaders, ministers, priests, rabbis, chaplains, monks and nuns, that there's a what's called a formation process. And so in this training, you are each in a formation process. Yeah. And at the same time, within the Dharma, particularly for people who have converted from no theistic tradition or have kind of incorporated Buddhism in addition to their kind of religion of origin that they grew up in or chose as young adults, there's a bit of part of the culture is to not identify oneself as a Buddhist. Like, as I was saying to Paul, under the tent that says Buddhist practitioner, nobody likes to say, I'm a Buddhist. It's a little bit like there's no I, or what's a Buddhist, or it's not a religion, it's a philosophy, you know, like, but if you leave that tent, and for you as you're going out to do the service work that you're doing as a chaplain, whether you're called that or not, you will be looked at as a representative of Buddhism. And whether under the tent, you might say to me, I don't know what a Buddhist is, and we could talk about that at lunch at length, you know, and have a great conversation. But if I'm like out in the grocery store parking lot and I tell somebody I'm a Buddhist chaplain, you know, like they need to know that really quickly, and I need to embody that. And we cannot have the conversation about, under the tent conversation about what's a Buddhist. Like people just need to know, oh, she's a Buddhist, you know, like, or she's a chaplain. Or so I wanted to have a session about what this means, what this looks like. As you're considering putting on a name tag that says, everybody see my name tag today? It says chaplain in big letters. So if I was to meet you dressed like this, even before I talk to you, you have already a message from me, right? And then Gil has dressed like a minister today with one more accessory. I'll put the other accessory on.
Paul says he doesn't see me as a minister in this outfit. He sees me as an insurance salesman. But this is what I wear when I'm going to be in some kind of function where I'm a minister kind of role. Like the last time I used it was for a wedding, and this is what I wore. So it might not be the best thing for a wedding, but it's what I have. It's what my uniform is. But I also have this. This makes it a little bit more clear that I'm a religious person, doesn't it? This is the stole that in Japanese is called a wagesa, but it's, I think in English they call it a stole, that here for IMC, for ministers at IMC. And IMC is ordained about, I don't know, 17, 18, 19 people as Theravadan ministers. And each of them has one of these.
And do you write anything on them?
No.
No.
I could, but no.
So this is a communication. It's a coming out, if you will. If it's a, here I am, here I stand. And so whether you know it or not, you're in this formation process. And if not now, then soon will be, in some ways, identifying yourself as a religious practitioner, chaplain, minister, leader, representative. Yeah. So I thought I could interview Gil and Paul about their experience doing this, and then we would generate some questions together. So I'll be Barbara Walters, but then you can all channel your own equivalent or something even better. Sound good? Does this make sense? Okay. So I was just thinking about that old story about when the people meet the Buddha and they say, "Are you a god?" They ask him, "What are you?" They notice something about him and they say, "Are you a spirit? Are you a god? Are you..." And the Buddha says, "I am awake." You know, they're trying to figure out, like, you know, what is this? So setting that tall order aside... can you each give us one or two examples of when, like you gave us an example of officiating at a wedding just now. Were there some other examples of when you are representing, if you will, Buddhism, when you're not in the Buddhist under the tent, but you're out and about? Some examples of that would be great. And shall we get you a microphone, Paul? Or shall you get you a microphone? Just give us a couple examples, either from now or from the distant past.
I have one. It gives me an opportunity to plug it, too. on the winter solstice at the back of San Francisco City Hall, there's a ceremony for all the people who died on the streets of San Francisco in the past year. And often I go there as a Zen priest. It's multi-denominational, and so I would go there, and I would bring some short chant or something that as a Zen chant.
Thank you.
Well, this is not answering the question directly, but example of taking on the kind of the persona or the role, the mantle of a minister. My wife and I were walking near our house one day, and there was in the front yard driveway of a house there, there looked like it was going to be a blowout fight. People were yelling, screaming. They looked like pretty nasty what was going on there. There was a woman involved and a guy and some other people watching, and it looked like this is not good. Someone's going to get serious problems here. And it looked like a dangerous place for me. But I went towards it and stood behind a car. So there was a car between me and them. And I kind of by the hood or something. And I said, "Hi, I'm a minister. Is there anything I can do to help here?" Everything calmed down. Just saying I was a minister was enough to make a huge difference in the whole scene. So this archetype does have a role and importance and a possibility. I wasn't dressed anyway, but nowadays people don't expect ministers to be dressed necessarily. So,
thank you.
And then the first time that I noticed that being ordained as a Zen priest meant something was soon after I was ordained, like maybe the next day or something. I was sitting in the bus stop in San Francisco to take a bus someplace, and someone came down next to me, sat down, and started to tell me their secrets of their deep life. I said, "Why this person?" Before that, no, people ignored me. I was in San Francisco, and people, if they didn't ignore me, they tried to avoid me. And now I was like an open door. I was like, I belong to everyone now. This is a feeling that now I belong to everyone, with shaved head and, you know, how I was. And so, you know, I didn't realize I was going to belong to people this way, and that people felt they could come up and just tell me things.
One of the people in the video said, and the other one agreed, "I'm a chaplain 24/7, no matter where I go." And I thought that was interesting, yeah. Did I see a hand in the audience? Do you have a question?
if you...
Sure. Or you can hold it and we'll do it later. Okay.
So this is a Barbara Walters style question, because I've heard you, Gil, you tell this story before about being a minister for the arguing people. And I remember you had told, it was a very funny joke, you didn't tell them that you were a Buddhist minister.
Right.
And like my impression from that story was that they had assumed you were of Christian faith or something. Yeah. And I was wondering, in the entire engagement, did it ever come up that you are a Buddhist teacher of any kind?
No, it was not
necessary.
It was very brief.
Ah, okay.
And so, there was no real conversation going on.
Mm-hmm.
But I assumed that they thought I was a Christian, if I just say I'm a minister.
Mm-hmm.
But I was going to let that be. I was just trying to make it situation safe.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And then when my son was in Little League, I would go to the Little League games and sit in the bleachers and be with other parents. And there was not a few times where they asked me, what do you do? And so I'm a Buddhist teacher. They would stand up and leave. So in terms of the charisma of office,
One time someone asked me that, and I said, well, I teach meditation. And the person said, and you make a living doing that?
And then what'd you say? No, not really.
But once, or occasionally, I get asked to go to hospital or a hospice where someone's either very sick or dying, and sort of administer a Buddhist version of last rites. And so I would go and I would chant something, usually the Heart Sutra or one of the traditional Zen chants. And once I did that for someone who was identified Buddhist, and the nurse came over after I finished and said, someone down the ward said, could she have some of that? And I said, oh, is she a Buddhist? She says, no, he just liked it. But part of it made me feel like there's something that we do in our practice that resonates with people, even if they don't know the tradition, or even if they don't know what was that sutra about or that chant about. It's like there's a commonality in our shared existence that I think our spirituality and our religious identity is trying to give a form to. I mean, that's a big part of my own thinking and way of relating to what I do as a spiritual identity.
And to clarify my earlier question, because I even actually in the video I noticed that both chaplains said that they were Jesus-loving Buddhists, and I thought that was really interesting. And I find myself in these situations where I would play up my understanding and affinity towards Christianity, where it feels like, oh, it seems like there's more resonance here. And like with Buddhism, I feel like it's like I've seen both situations happen where people are either drawn to it or repelled by it. And I'm like also playing around with these identities. And I was wondering whether this is skillful usage of archetypes, understanding that these are all constructs, and to what extent am I like doing a white lie situation and it's a bit awkward. Yeah.
She's a great Barbara Walters, so I'm going to let you guys answer that question.
I don't know. I don't have that issue. I don't think I've ever been in a situation where I felt compromised or had to represent, intentionally trying to represent myself as Christian in order to get someone's attention or get something going. So for me, that issue has never been an issue. But it's an issue for a lot of people when you do cross-religious interfaith chaplaincy. How can you talk to someone of a different faith? Are you allowed to? Is it ethical to do it and even not tell them. And the default, if you need to, is to tell them. And then find your way with that. If the situation is not so clear and you find there's no need to tell them because you have a nice conversation, it's good, then maybe you don't tell them. But if they ask you, can you do the Lord's Prayer for me, or can you do a Jewish prayer for me, then you say, oh, I'd be very happy to do that, but you should know that I'm not Catholic or I'm not Jewish. But if that's okay with you, and I wouldn't necessarily volunteer that I'm Buddhist right away, I'd just say, this is my situation. If they say, well, what are you? Then I'd say, I was a Buddhist. So I think you don't have to always be exposing yourself like who you are, but you should be ready to do it.
I shy away from doing something that's particularly from another faith tradition. You know, if I could generalize it in a way that was sort of pan traditions, that would be my strategy. And then, just as Gil said, you know, like if I was obliged, if someone said to me point blank, well, then what tradition are you? Then I would just say straightforwardly, this is what I am. And I would say a Zen Buddhist.
That's interesting. I think if in general public, I'd first say I'm a Buddhist, you know, and just leave it at that. Because a lot of people don't know what Theravadan Buddhism is or Insight Buddhism, and so I just leave it as Buddhism for now, and then if they ask me more, I can explain. And a Buddhist teacher, just leave it at that.
And once, I'll tell you the occasion when we have a hospice called Zen Hospice, and myself, and interestingly, another Norman, another Zen priest, we said, well, why don't, instead of calling it a Zen hospice, why don't we call it a Buddhist hospice? That would be more inclusive. And the other board member said, we don't think so.
Yeah.
We think Zen is wider than Buddhism, you know? I mean, everybody, you know, there's all sorts of Zen things, you know? And people sort of get that Zen, the cosmic doing just nothing thing. So we stuck with calling it a Zen hospice. So I do mention Zen.
Yeah. So this thing about, you know, being seen publicly, I mean, that wedding I did this summer, I performed this what was summer. I think it was before or after, I forget, maybe it was after the reception afterwards. The father of the bride came up to me and started telling me about his difficult life. And he basically, you know, I became a chaplain right then and there. And I was like, what, here, now? You know, it was kind of a strange moment for me to do that because I didn't know how much time I had and what was he asking. It seems like this was huge, what he was telling me. And so this, you know, to put yourself out as a, you know, as a Buddhist chaplain, Buddhist teacher, Buddhist something, people will approach you with, because they think that you are someone who can help. I've been invited to schools to... there was a school here nearby that kind of for a number of years, every year they invited me at least once a year to the, what do they call it? When all the classes got together.
General Assembly.
Maybe a General Assembly. And they would have some kind of religious person come and do like a blessing or a story or do something religious for them. And so I was a designated Buddhist and I was brought as a Buddhist minister to speak to a private school, a bunch of students. And so that was a role. And I because I was a Buddhist, clearly I was brought for that and introduced that way, then I thought it was appropriate and maybe important to tell a Buddhist story to the kids, to share something about Buddhism with them. that was both general enough and just wise enough, and also but to not, you know, proselytizing, just like a nice fable, Buddhist fable, for example, with a you know, a moral in it.
And how did you dress for the occasion?
I probably dressed something like this. But I didn't wear this, but you're just probably something like this.
Has anybody ever gotten mad at you for being a Buddhist teacher or priest? Really, like, brought you an axe to grind and just like...
My students.
As a collective or individually?
I think mostly individual, but sometimes it might have spread a little bit.
Not that I can remember, but maybe I'm blanking it out. I'm blocking it out.
When I was, I went to Turkey many years ago, to almost 30 years ago. And I quickly got a sense when I was in Turkey to not mention that I was Buddhist. Anything to do with it, because people... unprompted by me, I got a sense that there was this idea that people who don't believe in the God should be killed. So was that serious? So I wasn't going to say anything about being a Buddhist because they saw that as being, you know, an atheistic religion. So it's okay, I'm not going to say a word.
Thank you. So there's a vulnerability, there's a power, and there's a vulnerability.
Yeah.
Almost like the archetype is a symbol, and I think the tricky part in that is that as a symbol you can be dehumanized into just a symbol. Yeah. Conrad?
I kind of have a related question to that, which is, are there parts of the titling of yourself that you kind of recoil from? And I will give an example from my own life, like, yes, I have a personal training certification, but I want nothing to do with fitness because a lot of it's about conditional happiness, treating the body as this form. And if you're at a party or something like that, or engaging with the people, they'll immediately want to tell you all about their diet, their workout, or they're trying to justify themselves to you. And I'm like, I'm not the police here. Like, this is your body. And if there are parts of this titling process becoming this archetype that maybe parts of you recoiled from, you've had to like kind of struggle with to adopt in order to function in a larger society. I don't know if that makes sense.
In the Japanese Zen tradition, and in the Chinese, even though the words are different, the Japanese word is roshi. And literally it means something like lovable elder, you know, like grandpa.
Rabbi.
And then it has come to be like almost like the equivalent of guru, you know, or exalted teacher, exalted venerable teacher. And as a community, In the San Francisco Zen Center, we don't use that title. But one of the things many of us do is, like, informal occasions, we all have Buddhist names. Like, Gil has a Buddhist name, a Zen Buddhist name. We in a formal occasion or ceremony, will use our Buddhist name. And then outside that, it's optional, and most of us don't. And we also have two kinds of outfits. We have our high church outfit, and then we have our everyday walking about outfit. And then we have just regular clothes. So one of the probing questions in Zen is, what should I wear? And for the high church ceremonies, you wear your full outfit.
you know, right down to little white booties. So when I come here, I think, oh, what should I wear? And then I defer to how Gil dresses. But quite honestly, I just forgot today. I do have a jacket like that somewhere.
I want you to wear your robes today.
Oh, yeah.
I was picturing robes, but...
Yeah.
What doubts have you had in your role as a teacher, a priest, a leader, a religious representative in the public? I'm assuming you've had doubts and expecting that you might let us know one or two of them. Although that could be a very personal question, although Barbara Walters would not shy away.
Well, I have I've had a lot of doubts about the projection people have on me. There's a lot of projection in this role, and so just to feel it coming towards me and knowing how to handle it, how to receive it. I mean, in the early years, I was like, no, it's not that way. I'd like, you know, stop. And then slowly learning to have a kind of comfort with it and a relationship with it that hopefully is healthy. But I think there's ongoing doubt. Really? That's who you think I am? You should just talk to my wife. And I have doubt about, sometimes I have doubt whether I'm the right person for someone to talk to. Their particular psychological condition is so challenging and so complex that maybe I'm not the one that they should be holding on to and depending on as the one who's going to, provide what they're looking for.
Yeah, I would echo that. When I started having a teacher position, I went back and did a master's in psychotherapy because I felt like, I always thought the role of a teacher was like when we're all on retreat, and someone says, well, I'm following my breathing like this, do you have any suggestions? No. But actually... What arrives is often much more complex and with a lot of psychological referencing. And just as Gil said, I've just accepted this now as just part of what I do, that there's certain things that I am not skilled enough are capable of providing the care that this person needs, and I find myself saying to other people that I'm mentoring to become teachers, it's like, know what you know, and know what you don't know. No. And when I look back, I think now, in a kind of foolish way, I just took up the whole thing blithely, thinking, oh yeah, the law will be fine, only to discover very difficult situations arise for people. And that sometimes I think, how could I possibly say anything to anyone? Each one of us is such a complex event, And we do have a saying in Zen, like, don't know, And so I remind myself of a saying by Carl Jung. And Carl Jung said, even if I'd had 100 sessions with someone, when they walk in the door, I remind myself, I don't know who this person is. So I try to keep that in the foreground.
And it's not Jennifer, Barbara, it's not it's not quite to the topic, which is how we are in the public situation, but a place where I have a lot of doubt, uncertainty, questioning, is the centrality of my role in this IMC community. And, you know, I'm the central leader. And is that okay? How central should I be? Should I not be as central as I am? And, you know, where is my proper role here? And just before the pandemic, I was all set to try to decentralize my role. But then the pandemic actually made it more central. So I'm still kind of dealing with it and trying to find my way with that question. And I don't have clarity about that. And
I think in systems, hierarchical systems, which religious communities are in general, as well as corporations, the higher one gets in the system, the less feedback they get. So, because you're protected in some way by your authority, you know. So, how do you get feedback, or how do you find your way?
I think asking for it helps.
To go
to people and say, you know, what do you think about this? And do you have any, you know, what do you think about what I'm doing or what I'm thinking, or what do you think about my, you know, my role here and what I just did? And so I think asking for feedback is one way when people are not ready to do it themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the system I'm in, there's about 20 teachers, and there's a few of them are senior to me, and then there's many that are juniors, but there's a substantial number who are peers, and we have all sorts of groupings and committees in which we function as peers. And then maybe the weakness of it is direct feedback. You know? Certainly the peer meetings in a kind of wonderful, like someone told me, in Tibetan, if you ask for something, that you won't get a no. You may not get a yes, but you won't get a no. But the no is implicit in the not yes. And the Japanese system that we've inherited is something similar. You know, you might put out an idea and nobody will say, that's a bad idea. But they will not say, that's a good idea. So you have to kind of like listen carefully, like not good, or the absence of affirmation is disapproval. And so, but to be honest, sometimes I think, you know, I'm going to do this until somebody objects. And then actually often nobody objects, so I just keep doing it.
So some of the public role that I've had, you know, with interfaith things, you know, not just parents at Little League, but also when there are other ministers, Christian ministers, Jewish rabbis, and so on, interfaith things. There are sometimes, not a few times, where I felt like I was not really wanted there. Like that I was looked upon as not real or not valuable, or, you know, just I was being put up with, or, you know, people were tolerating me rather than, you know, embracing me or including me. So, you know, so that was part of the deal too in this kind of role. It's unfortunate, but it comes along.
Other questions from the studio audience?
Yeah.
I've got a bunch. But one is, one of the questions I encounter frequently from family and friends is, well, what are you going to do with that? Like chaplaincy, or people want to know your 5-year plan. And I feel very comfortable saying things like, I don't know. Things will present themselves as they come along because we don't have a crystal ball. But I'm curious how you were met with those questions, if you even were, or how you continue to in your vocation.
My family never protested or complained. I mean, the only concern my father had when I was ordained as a Zen priest, he didn't say it. Yeah, he had a couple. He came to me and said, "You know, well, you know, I like this Buddhist philosophy, but I don't understand why you would practice it." Because he was concerned I was going to have a boring life.
Was he right?
No.
I just, it never occurred to me to ask myself, what's my plan? You know? I was just so enamored with practice. I mean, when I was, you know, in my mid-20s, it became the central theme of my life. And it, up until that point, I was just sort of traveling around. And so it wasn't like I gave up some fabulous career to immerse in Buddhism. It just sort of, and it was in Asia too, so it wasn't like my family was right there saying, well, what are you doing? They were on the other side of the world. And so I didn't have to confront that question. But I remember many years later, I started to think about it, and I asked my teacher, Mel Weissman, and I said, did you or do you ever have a plan for your life? And he looked like me at me like, what? what are you talking about? You know, how can you have a plan for your life? It's constantly changing, you know? And I thought, okay, sounds good to me. I'll take that plan.
In terms of my family, a nice moment was my older son got me wanted me to come and speak to his philosophy class in high school, right down the street here. And that was quite something, you know. I didn't want to be. If my parents came to my high school, I didn't want to. I didn't want to know who they were. Didn't want them to be seen with them. But he wanted me to come to his class, and so there I was coming as a Buddhist teacher, and I was asked to talk about Buddhist ethics to the class, and so that was kind of a nice. You know, I was accepted, at least locally, by one student. And that was nice. And so that's also a public role, come to high school and teach to a class. And I've done that a fair amount, going to classes. I've had classes come here. They came here, but for many years there was a middle school, ninth graders. I remember how many was high school, ninth grade, that would come here to their school did a year on introduction to world religions, and so I think it was November was the Buddhism month, so every November they would come here and spend a few hours with me here in this hall, so there I was now clearly represented of Buddhism. It was important that I hold that place because that's what I'm there for, and I was there to introduce them to Buddhism and meditation and mindfulness and the whole gamut. So that was it was always fun. I mean, and I was always so impressed. These ninth graders were so mature and wow, so great questions. And it all went very well until one day I told one of them that I didn't know what was on television since 1972, and when I said that. My credibility, you could see my credibility in their eyes just sank. And I had to kind of work to get that credibility up again. That's why Barbara Walters is like, who?
Right, right. Other questions? Did I see you get a mic, Sri?
Yeah, this is a little bit of a dilemma for me. So how relevant it is to disclose that I'm training to be undergoing chaplaincy training in the context of, let's say, somebody's suffering because of not necessarily physical pain, but more of a lot of emotional pain related to some health condition, let's say. Is it better to kind of not disclose that you are trained to be a chaplain, or just help them out and anyway, irrespective of what the disclosure is?
What's the context for this?
In the sense that, suppose if... I guess it depends on the individual cases, but let's say if they knew that you are a chaplain, or at least have some chaplaincy training background, then that person might be more receptive to your being fully present and sort of willing to accept the... what's the right way to say? In a, provide some comfort, right? As opposed to, in other words, give a little bit more credibility to what I may be trying to help, right? I'm not going to solve the problem, but...
So if it's a family member outside of a hospital, you know, just in the public world, and someone knows you're in the chaplaincy training and wants to talk to you about some deep personal issue that they have, because they trust the chaplain more than anyone else... And then you might say, listen to them and say, you know, and protect you. You might say, you know, I just started my training. You should realize I just started my training. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I certainly can be sit here with you. But mostly my role at this point in my training is just to be your companion. Mm-hmm. And just that protects you, protects them, and you don't get pulled into the web of problem solving, fixing their lives. So I can be your companion and... So you know, please, let's go for a walk, and you can tell me what's going on.
Okay, thank you. Yeah.
I often think, you know, we call it chaplains and chaplaincy, but it's really being a good human being, you know, and coming from the heart of the virtue of a good human being. I find when we come at it from that position, we're much less likely to kind of propose, and this is what you should be doing, even to infer it or indirectly, you know, because so much of it is just about being present for someone and respecting and deeply listening to them and empathizing and sympathizing with what's bothering them and difficult for them. And, you know, making conclusions about that. I find it that when we do that, often organically... some kind of healing or some way forward presents itself. And even when it does, like, can we take credit for it? You know, I think it's more like hopefully we contributed something positive, and that what arose out of that was just part of the virtue of our deeply caring.
Have you ever made some big mistakes or had a failure? I mean, this is starting to sound a little rosy, you know, like it all works really well all the time because you're a good person, but... What about mistakes or shortcomings or?
I
regrets?
I have on occasions got caught up in just to what I said to you, Sri, like, and underestimated. Like, I'm thinking of one person in particular who had a deeply nagging self-criticism, and that led to disastrous consequences. And I did later think, you know, maybe I would have, which I would do now, I would like, I mean, there have been times when I have literally, you know, called the police and had someone taken off to a mental health facility. And I've made mistakes in the past for not doing that and assuming something could work itself through.
Hmm. So maybe as you matured or gained more experience, you knew what you couldn't do and to get somebody else to do something.
Yeah.
I see. Okay.
I think one of the mistakes I made a few times as a teacher is someone comes and tells me about some terrible thing someone else had done to them, and I believed them too easily, and I got alarmed too easily, and I went to work to try to, you know, right the wrong, to find out that it was not, that it was very different, that there was a certain degree of delusion operating on the person who was complaining. And so, you know, I approach people like, you did this terrible thing, but I didn't even wait to find out from the other person, what happened? What's your side of this? So this is taking one side, because the first side they come was so, the righteousness of it or the justice of it was somehow, I was caught in it.
It's somewhat related to that. A couple of times I've been suspicious of a resident who I thought was using drugs. And I would ask them, are you using drugs? And they'd look me in the eye and say, no, I'm not using drugs. And I thought, okay, well, that solves that. Only to find out, no, that was completely, you know, a fabrication. They were using drugs. And so part of the consequence of that is when someone wants to be part of the community in residence, that we will ask about their history of, you know, substance abuse or recovery or whatever. And it's somewhat of a fine line, you know, because the vast majority of people who come to a spiritual community are not actively, they may have in the past, actually, it's surprising how many people for whom substance abuse is a catalyst for taking the spiritual path. Yeah, but I've done that myself, like just sort of accepted someone at face value when they said no. And actually someone came up to me. They were in residence, and after 6 months they came up to me and said, you know, you just so innocently trust me, I have to tell you, I'm doing heroin. They were living at the Zen Center and doing heroin. And it never occurred to me, once they said, no, I'm not doing it, that was the case. And it's a bit of a dilemma to me, because I certainly, it's my inclination to trust what somebody says as the truth. And the dilemma for me is, I can't see the boundaries or the usefulness of being suspicious about people, you know? So I'm not quite sure how to resolve that, but I have made mistakes.
And being naive is not a heinous characteristic,
yeah.
Right? It's got some some beauty to it. Yeah, interesting. Thank you. Somebody grabbed a microphone.
I wanted to know if you would talk again about the roles, similarities or differences that you would see in a minister, a guru, and a teacher, however you want to describe it, Roshi, versus a chaplain.
Who do you want to answer that question?
All of you.
Do you want to go first?
Sure. I do not identify as a Dharma teacher. I have been invited to sanghas from time to time to teach, and I usually tell stories or talk about something like to get a conversation going to generate practice. I am ordained as a minister, but not Buddhist. I'm an interfaith minister. I have two primary spiritual traditions or streams that fill the aquifer of my life. Functionally, though, I'm sitting up here, so I might look like a Dharma teacher, but I don't. But I'm a educator of chaplains, like, so, you know, and Buddhist in this setting. Chaplains are out and about in the world. Ministers are typically in their own setting, or priests, or like they have their place and people come in. Chaplains go out and about, you know. Chaplains tend to be more maverick in temperament, and ministers in congregations tend to be more traditional. So chaplaincy is a specialized ministry with lots of types of ministry. Typically people train, they grow up in the church, they go to college, they're a deacon, they go to seminary, they're ordained as a minister, they serve in a congregation. Very few, after the congregation or instead of the congregation, go out into the world as chaplains. Some churches have ministers that do a lot of outreach, but they're still considered ministers, you know. And chaplaincy has also been associated with people in crisis. So like the interfaith street chaplaincy group that you all are serving, some of you are serving with the SF Night Ministry, you know, those people are in crisis and they use the word chaplain there. I do not identify as a 24/7 every day of the week, like the people in the video said last night about, like, something's going on, I'm like, okay, somebody got that? Good, because I'm going to keep going, but I'm going to, you know, like, I don't consider myself, I find that unsustainable personally, you know. My good wishes are there, you know, like I might send metta, or whenever I hear an ambulance, I think to myself, somebody's having a bad day, you know, like, I think like, I'm always caring in my thoughts about things, but I'm not on duty all the time. Those are some of my thoughts. I'll pass to that way. Do you have a thought about the difference, priest, teacher, chaplain?
I don't know. I don't know if I have a good answer for you, but I'll offer this. No, and there's a range, and they all bleed into each other, kind of, and where they fit. But to be simple, on one end, a Dharma teacher, in my mind, is interested in suffering and the end of suffering in people, for individuals. Like, that's like everything's oriented around that in some way. A minister is a person who supports, mediates, helps people, guides people, enables people in their connection to their spirituality, their religious life, that's wider and bigger than the idea of just suffering. And a minister might not know so much about suffering and the end of suffering. They might not have gone so deep into the practice as a minister has. In fact, I think most ministers I know, Buddhist ministers, I think they haven't done as deep as Dharma teachers have. And that a chaplain is someone who, like Jennifer said, who supports people in spiritual religious life, kind of, in the middle of their crisis or special events, where you meet them where they're at rather than coming to the place. And then there's a guru, or I don't know, the grandfather or grandparent, you know, in I don't know what to call it here, but I sometimes say I'm like an abbot here at IMC. And an abbot has a different role than a Dharma teacher or a minister or a chaplain. So there's also the kind of being a central organizing principle, leader for a community. And how all these different areas overlap and relate to each other is something that takes a lot of care and attention and fluidity to move between and to adjust and somehow keep the relationships with everyone clean with all these different roles. There was I say a little bit reserved or quite reserved in my place here in this community as the abbot or something. There are other people who are much more social than I am. I'm somewhat reserved and held back. And that's partly temperament, but partly also it's the way I navigate. And it's been successful enough. And one sometimes when it crosses over, there's been problems. There was one person who was seeing me a lot as a kind of a teacher, but there were personal reasons why the person became kind of friends with my wife, and then we started to become like family friends, her and her partner, and then my wife would go for walks with her and just tell her a little bit about her husband, right, about me, and the woman got furious at me and came to see my office and gave me the riot act about how terrible I was. Mm. And I was like, who are you? You're supposed to be a Buddhist teacher? And what do you know? And I couldn't, I never understood what it was about. I mean, it wasn't like I did anything like, I don't know, but somehow I wasn't behaving in the way she expected me to behave. And so there, that's, you know, how to navigate the projection, the expectations that people have in my role. And so being reserved is partly to protect everyone involved.
Part of my interest in facilitating Buddhist chaplains is that I've noticed many people who, in a wonderfully dedicated way, took practice to heart and it became who they were. It was their primary identity. And then there's a kind of an... Well, you can become a teacher, a Dharma teacher, but then there's not so many other archetypes that fit, that segue from that life immersion into practice. There's not so many archetypes that fit in our society, and I think chaplaincy is one of them. And that's a big appeal to me. No, I think, in very simple language, that our practice is training us to be good people. You know, to be kind and generous and thoughtful people. And as I was saying, you know, in response to Sri, I think that's also the core of chaplains. And they build skill sets around the context in which they're ministering. You know, like a hospital chaplain has a skill set that a prison chaplain doesn't have, but this vice versa too. The prison chaplain has a skill set. For me, that such an archetype which, to my mind, segues so well from someone who's immersed in the practice. But it's also accepted in our society. But sometimes I ask myself, well, what other kind of archetypes could we promote? You know? And you know, the one that rattles around in my head is life coach. You know? This is becoming not quite a well-established archetype in our society, but it's heading in that direction. And certainly I know quite a few therapists who have a background in Buddhism. But none of them that I know describe themselves as Buddhist therapists, Buddhist psychotherapists.
Yeah, we had what Paul's saying, there was a woman who, in the first year, 20 years ago of this program, that she was in the Vipassana scene quite a bit in certain volunteer roles, and the only way forward was to become a teacher. And so people were kind of opening a door for her like that and trying to make it work a little bit for her, some kind of like something, but it just wasn't working. It wasn't taking. And then she did this program, and she went then CP and became a chaplain, and she individuated. She came into her full personhood. That's what she was made to be, a chaplain. She wasn't made to be a Buddhist teacher. It just was a poor fit for who she was as a person. And so what Paul's saying is that as these roles develop, it used to be in the 1970s, the only option was to be a superstar Buddhist teacher. There's so few Buddhist kind of people in this kind of role. And now there's a lot more roles and lots, you know, the standard has gone down, luckily, from the superstars that, you know. And there's all these other options where people are finding and individuating, and chaplaincy is one of them.
And, you know, for you, I said this to some of you in the interviews, I think to come to this training, to be here and fully engage, is to head in a particular direction. You know, you're heading, whether it's any of the above archetypes, nouns, roles, this is all in a territory that you could call heading north, right? And you're not heading west, and you're not heading east or south. And so you're heading north, right? So let's say north is over here by the camera. You know, north, getting north might look like this, you know, like a real, if I tell you exactly what happened to me and any of us, it would sound like a straight line, but, you know, it's all a zigzag, you know, but I think finding the direction, you know, is something to really celebrate. The other thing I think I've seen is there's an internal process and an external process. So when you mentioned, there was a question about how much to say about myself to somebody else, you know. Or I think, why do some people end up like somebody last year? The jails can't get enough of this one person that was in this training last year. Like, to say to them, you don't have to say yes every time they invite you to do something. You know, like almost a lot came at him at once. And then other people are like, I'm not getting any traction with some service role. And I think there's the inner and the outer, you know. And they begin to find each other, but it takes some time. So for some, there's an inner call that helps you really. And other times, it's like, I need the outer to draw me forward. And so there's a patience and a forbearance, you know, that you're all experiencing for one reason or another. So those are two thoughts I have to kind of the discernment, the formation, the, you know, we can tell you stories that in hindsight sound really reasonable, but at the time they were confusing or discouraging or lonely or took great sacrifice, you know, like, so. And it's, I think, being here is helping you clarify, discern, and in some ways,
A teacher once said to me, the future enters us long before we're aware of it. This is Angelus Arian. The future enters us long before we're aware of it. So I guess I would invite each of you to consider to hold on to that your future, whatever is farther north by coming here, is on its way, you know. And to just, I mean, Paul and Gil, you couldn't have said you would have ended up here when you knocked on some monastery door decades ago. Mm-hmm. Have you surprised yourselves in what's happened?
Never dreamt of it.
Not even an inkling.
Yeah.
So naive. I'm kidding. So that's, you know, that's the kind of formation process. Yeah. Because I don't want us to sound up here like we figured it all out and it was really easy, and you just add water, you know, like, and then, you know, it's a process over and over and over again.
I was wondering if any of you or all of you would be willing to reflect on and share some comments on when this role brings you into sort of the intense zone of some sort of conflict. I had, you know, one experience of this that I thought was something akin to hospital chaplaincy, where I sort of parachuted down into the middle of a family conflict. Once in a at least once in a Dharma Center context, where there was some concern about potential misconduct and a raising of concerns in a hierarchical situation, I think prison chaplaincy is loaded with the potential of, because there's so much, institutionalized aggression on all sides of every line that can be drawn. And so I would love to hear any or all of your comments about that. You know, I don't know if this training embraces or touches on any of disciplines of conflict resolution, or it's basically, you know, it's just left to the sort of overall perspective of mm-hmm. you know, doing no harm and holding an unbiased mind. But maybe there's more.
It's one of the roles of a chaplain, of Buddhist teacher, a minister, is to mediate conflict, whether you want it or not, to do so. People will look for you for that role. So then the question is, will you do it? I've had a lot of experience with it because I was the chair of the Spirit Rock Ethics Committee for 15 years or something like it or more. And so all kinds of things came through, both at Spirit Rock and other communities that I stepped into and helped mediate, middle the conflict. And when it was within Spirit Rock, it was, and I think also at San Francisco Zen Center, there were times where I was involved in something, was a lot of conflict or tension, and I had to confront my elders, the people who are my teachers, and that was interesting, very, you know, interesting or challenging and turning point in something psychologically inside of me. To be able to stand and hold my own against the people who I revered as my elders in the tradition. So I see it as, you know, part and parcel of this whole area.
Did you feel that you had training that helped to serve as foundation for meeting those moments, or do you look back on it and feel that you wish that you had other kinds of training to help meet those moments?
No, I don't have any wish that I had any different training myself. I think that the decades of practice trained me in many ways. And then there was all kinds of small little ways, and there were training all along the way of ways of communicating, ways of talking, ways of being together in a group, ways to navigate group dynamics, that kind of was added informally here and there as I went along. So over decades, you know, I absorbed a lot, but I never went through a specific training. But I think it's important to do. So like some of the people that I ordain here at IMC as ministers, I've told them that before I'll ordain them that they have to do take a course in conflict resolution, because I think it's such an important part of the role.
I have a tangential story. I was working on a project for quite some time as a consultant, and I wasn't, it took a lot of effort to consult, because in some ways they were seeking my perspective, but then when I offered it, there was a lot of resistance. So I think one mistake I made is I didn't charge them enough money for my consultation. And then there were some things I didn't really change my mind about it. I said, if you want to get from here to there, you know, here's how you know, this is it, you know, like this is what's entailed. And then it didn't happen, you know, and they were kind of unhappy with me. So for a long time, I just kept kind of being okay with it and still being involved, and like this push me, pull me, you know, it kind of felt like this kind of dynamic, you know. And I just got fired from the gig after quite some time, because I did something that I thought was the right thing to do, and my partner didn't like what I did in a period of 10 minutes within an hour and a half meeting, like, where I just was like, I think this is, you know, and if you were to say, what are those moments in your life where you kind of like really stuck to your guns because it mattered to you and it didn't go so well? This would be one of those moments, you know. Didn't go so well, you know, at all. Yeah. And I'm saddened by it, but when I think back about those 10 minutes, I keep thinking, that was the matter at hand, you know, like I said, let's pause and just stop talking for a few minutes. Let's take a pause, you know. And this is in a Dharma context, and this person was just livid with me that I directed the people in the meeting to just take a pause. Just like, so it was so disproportionate. And so I think I have a good tolerance for disproportionate kind of freaky things that happen, you know, like it's my strength and my bravado. So I think people know they can kind of push at me and I won't completely crumble, you know, so. But it really shocked me. Like, and I'm still very confused about it. Like, I'm like, what? Was this like the straw that broke the camel's back? Am I so out of it that I really don't get what she was talking about, you know? And I think of harm and conflict coming from like ignorance, deliberate, egregious name-calling, denigration. You know, like I go to like the cardinal sins when I think about like right and wrong at some level. You know, like it's so. There's other parts of my life where I just get into trouble because I'm mouthy, and I just, you know, like have this. I come from a culture where people say what they think. It don't care if somebody else is talking. You know, like I'm the mellow one. You know, so like I've learned that I have to apologize my way out of overstepping, because I just come from a family of Bengal tigers. You know, and I'm like the one with no teeth. You know, but still, you know, relative to the kitty cats running around, I'm still a tiger, you know, so I get in trouble that way, you know. And so In my training as a chaplain for conflict resolution, we used the ritual of reconciliation from the Catholic Church. It was a Catholic hospital, which is the call to confession, which is a form of truth-telling, like, I think you are or you were, and really kind of, and then the other person taking that in and deciding whether it was true or not, and then some form of confession, you know. And then the conflict would flip over, and then the other person would say, and I think you are or were, put out the opinion, and then the person would consider and confess or not. And then we'd be kind of looking at confession and what is reconciliation? Is there reconciliation if people don't have regret over what happened? We talked about penance a lot, like new behavior. So in the future, you know, I will remember, and I will try to remember so hard to not say that thing that really upsets you, you know, or to speak when you're speaking, you know, and I am sorry, and it is rude, and I am arrogant, and, you know, but I now that I know how much it harms you, I feel great regret, and I promise to, you know, change my ways. So that was like a whole religious umbrella of conflict resolution that I was trained in, which made for very interesting group meetings, as you can imagine, because we were all like practicing telling each other what we thought of each other. It was very interesting, yeah. And I think with the situation I mentioned with this other person, if I knew how it would have ended, I would never have done what I did. But I don't think that what I did was wrong. But the impact, like where it led us into this, you know, breakdown, if I knew that would happen, I wouldn't do it that way again. That's as close as I can come to taking responsibility. Oh, are you going somewhere?
Yeah.
Did you let us know where you're going?
Yeah, I sent you all this Slack.
Oh.
Well, you say, oh. That Jack Lou Kent's retirement ceremony.
Oh. You want to tell everybody who she is?
Jacqueline Kent is used to lead, well, will no longer be leading, but was an amazing kind of director for the chaplaincy program at the Institute of Buddhist Studies, and she's also a priest at her own church in Marin, right?
No, she's in Santa Cruz.
Santa Cruz, yes. So,
Ocean
sorry, I did send it to all of you. I apologize.
Well, why don't you give Dajia, because she's come and spoken for our group here. She knows our
program. She knows us.
So can you convey Jennifer, Paul, and my kind of congratulations and warm wishes that it's been, you know, wonderful to have her in this chaplaincy training family.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And AJ.
Tell her that we sent you. Yes. They sent me. Did we get to your question, your query?
Could I add something to his question just real quick? Because, and I don't know if you want to talk about it, so no pressure, but you mentioned to me something that was really helpful, which was not a conflict you were having, but a conflict you were kind of helicoptered into when people were punching each other. Yeah. And, you know, when you talk about, you know, what's talking about, what do you do with conflict or, you know, when there's somebody's fighting, like, can you say how you handled that?
Well, one thing in that situation is things went south and I thought, can we create something that's a corrective experience that can bring out their better natures? You know, like they were in their worst, in their grief, and there was a big fight. But they were still on the property. So I worked it out with some of the other leadership. Like, can they all come back and can we have a redo so they can do what needs to be done here, saying goodbye to a loved one, and end on that note instead of just the big fight, you know? So it was like, can I create conditions where really people can add to that a moment of goodbye, because what they missed by having the fight was the ability to say goodbye. Yeah.
Thanks for
saying sure.
That.
That's a shorthand. Yeah. I didn't get hit though. Ducked. No, actually, I left the room and I took a long time for me to process whether I had made a mistake by leaving the room. Because I knew they were like the Hatfields and the McCoys. They were chomping at the bit already. Yeah.
I'm worried your phone's flashlight is on and their battery will be dead.
Oh, thank you. Well, have we done this interview right, guys? What do you think?
You're Barbara Walters. You know all about these things. We just hear answering questions.
What's a question you are glad I didn't ask you?
Let's see.
Or, what's the question that if you had the answer to would set you free? Chaplains have good questions.
Well, the question that's rattling around in my head, I don't know if I want an answer to it, but it's a certain
microphone.
It's the question that's rattling around in my head is this a time to make radical change at San Francisco Zen Center?
So you wake up or go to sleep thinking about that, I'll bet. Quite a bit. Great question.
Any thoughts, Bill?
Nothing wise to offer.
Gil, are you...
No, we didn't ask for a while.
What about the future, Gil? Like, you've served in a lot of capacities for a period of time, and is there succession planning for you here? Do you have an idea of how the last chapter of your life might unfold?
There's no succession planning, and I can say more about that, but except that the plan is that it'll show itself when the time comes, given some hope that I keep living.
Until the time's never going to come.
Well, just living long enough for the context to evolve and to becomes clear what should happen next. And there's a lot of things still being put in place, so we're growing and developing these things. So that's the basic plan now. But what your question prompts me to say, in terms of all these roles that chaplain, Dharma teacher, minister, abbot, all these things have, one of them that was a surprise for me that wasn't my forte or my interest or wasn't in the horizon at all when I started to train to be a Dharma teacher or was ordained as a Zen priest. And that was visionary. And that started very small, that in the first years that I started teaching, there was a sitting group that met Monday nights in Palo Alto. I was invited to come and be the teacher for the group. So I taught every Monday for a couple of years. And at some point I said, you know, this group is ready for something more than just coming and sitting Monday night. A next step for them would be do a half-day retreat. So that was a visionary move. Like I had a vision of what their practice was would support her. And then sometime later, the vision was to have a day long. Sometimes later was a vision to have a second meeting during the week. And so then at some point, the vision was, we should have a center of our own. That would make a big difference. We were meeting three days a week. We had day-longs in a church on Saturdays. We had all kinds of things going on. So let's put it all together. And I saw a vision of that if we had a spiritual home, people would relate to that home very different than being so itinerant. That we were moving around having different sittings in different places. And I thought that people have a whole different relationship to their own spirituality, to their community life, if we had a center. So as the community grew, part of my role was to have a vision of where the community can grow next. And since, in a sense, I knew more about the practice and the potential of it in theory than a lot of the people who hadn't practiced as much as me, my idea was to have a vision of what was possible for them to grow into. And that sense of a visionary then gets more and more grandiose the bigger we get, right? So then retreat centers and, you know, it keeps growing because the foundation is bigger. It makes sense for something else. What's next? So, visionary.
I have enjoyed working with the two of you for a while, and it's one of the things I've appreciated is just the possibilities. You know, you're both very like, okay, maybe, you know, compared to, you know, like, there's a lot of possibility in each of you that I feel like I really benefited from being around. So here
is
we are.
Is there a prize tipped under our seat?
Yes, there is. No, there's not. I'm sorry. He got Barbara Walters confused with Oprah, who gives things away under the seat. I know you're disappointed there isn't a car underneath your seat.
Oh, I thought they haven't watched TV in like 4 years.
That's right. That's why they don't know about that, right?
She prepped us by telling us a little bit about Barbara Walters and Oprah.
Well, to all the pioneers, we give our thanks, including those in the media. It feels like it's a good time to take a break, but let me just look around the room. Okay. Thank you for talking about yourself so much, gentlemen. I know it's a stretch for you. You'd much rather be talking about the Dharma than about yourselves. So thanks for indulging us today. We may have to turn this interview into a transcript for future years. Pretty rich. Thanks, everybody. The time is 3:15. Let's take a good 20-minute break and do some tending to the physical building. If you could push a broom or wipe down a counter or empty the trash if it's full, or was there, tidy up the kitchen. Thank you all.